Coming up on Tech Nation, NYU marketing professor Adam Alter challenges our perception of ourselves and our behaviors with Irresistible, the rise of addictive technology, and the business of keeping us hooked. Then on Tech Nation Health, chief correspondent Daniel Kraft talks about the cutting edge of stem cell therapies today and in the future. And Second Genomes, Dr. Kareem DeBag tells us about linking bacteria in the gut to the inflammation experienced in IBD, irritable bowel disease. All this coming up on this week's Tech Nation.
Let's take five with Moira Gunn. This is 5 Minutes.
Ever since I was a kid and developed a keen interest in my brother's Boy Scout manual and its how-to on earning merit badges, I've been into how-tos. My current favorite is How to Build an Island, brought to you by China. Oh, they're not the only folks to build an artificial island or two, but they certainly have stepped it up to a whole new level. If you look on your map, you'll see that as big as China is, it has only a modest shoreline on the South China Sea. While the South China Sea has more significant borders with Vietnam, the Philippines, Malaysia, and others. Surely it must sting to see the resources that go with that great body of water and its strategic location outside of your control, all the while enjoying the benefits of your name. Instead of requesting a name change, China has gone deep into the South China Sea, some 600 miles from its southernmost dirt, Hainan Island, and built a set of artificial islands. Thanks to modern technology, this is a very simple how-to. In a three-step process, you first locate a naturally occurring base structure, like a barely submerged rock formation or a coral reef. Then bring in the old dredging barges, the ones that scrape sand, rock, whatever, from the seafloor and chop it up into pieces. And then critically, step three, aim the whole thing at your base structure. Now it's best to have a plan. Do you just want a big hill? Or would you like a long and narrow spit of dirt, say 10,000 feet long, so you could, say, land a military jet? With the technology portion of this commentary completed, let the politics begin. And that includes the national interests of any number of nations, and not just those on the South China Sea. For perspective, let's say your neighbor Fred decided to do some dry land dredging of his own and thought that a landscaped hill in the corner of his yard would be nice. Only the height of this hill is well over your head, and the corner of his yard is immediately on the other side of the fence from your picnic table. You speak nicely with Fred about it, and Fred says, "Hey, this is my backyard. And by the way, don't fly over my hill either." This is not unlike what's been going on with these Nouveau Islands, some a mere 100 miles from the Philippines. China claims it has the right to build these islands under something called the 9-Dash Lines, previously known as the 11-Dash Lines, and once asserted to be 10-Dash Lines, but that doesn't matter. China is building air bases on what has now grown to a collective 2,000 acres of landfill and has asserted full territorial rights. The U.S. did some freedom of navigation patrols and was told so definitively, as were any number of fishing boats. Sometime back, the Philippines filed a claim with the Permanent Court of Arbitration in The Hague, which is also binding on China, having signed an international treaty. The result is in, and the dashed lines are out. China has no legal basis to claim sovereignty. And then there's that nasty business of all that environmental damage. China is rejecting this decision out of hand, and who knows where it will go from here, except there'll be a fight. So let's not forget the biggest Boy Scout how-to of them all. Be prepared. I'm Moira Gunn. This is 5 Minutes.
5 Minutes is produced at the studios of KQED-FM in San Francisco. 5 Minutes is a production of Tech Nation Media. I'm Paul Lancour.
From San Francisco, I'm Moira Gunn, and this is Tech Nation. Today on Tech Nation, how we may be addicted to our technology. It's called behavioral addiction. I speak with NYU marketing professor Adam Alter about Irresistible, the rise of addictive technology, and the business of keeping us hooked. Then on Tech Nation Health, chief correspondent Daniel Kraft talks about the cutting edge of stem cell therapies today and in the future. And Second Genome's Dr. Kareem DeBag talks about linking bacteria in the gut to the inflammation experienced in IBD, irritable bowel disease. Before I read Adam Alter's book, I said to myself, I wonder if I'm addicted to any technology. Then I read, 70% of us are exactly that.
Yeah, it's an incredibly high number. There's a lot of research that looks into it and suggests that even though you'd imagine addiction applies to a very small part of the population, this new form of addiction, behavioral addiction and tech addiction, is actually very democratic. It applies to most of us.
And so we have behavioral addiction, and we also talk about substance addiction, which is what we typically think.
Right.
And yet they share some common characteristics. In fact, I was quite moved to read your passage on heroin addiction among American soldiers during the Vietnam conflict, and I was alarmed at the numbers.
Yeah, there were tens of thousands, even more perhaps, maybe into the hundreds of thousands of Vietnam vets who were, when they were there in combat, the GIs became addicted to heroin. They were basically very bored. There wasn't a lot for them to do when they weren't in battle. We have this image of people in war zones just being engaged all the time. And they found a lot of the time was boring. And so what happened was they were a captive audience, and there was a lot of heroin being produced in the area at the time. And so they were a perfect audience for it. And they started to use a lot of the heroin. You know, what happens with heroin addiction is that 95% of people, as they're trying to get off the drug, relapse at least once. And so President Nixon at the time was very concerned that these people, maybe 100,000 of them or more, would come back into the country and they'd be a huge public health concern. And he didn't know if they'd have enough beds in hospitals to treat them, and he was very worried about that. So he sent over one Republican and one Democrat to go and see as a bipartisan effort to see what was going on there. They got off the plane. The minute they were off the plane, they were offered heroin as well. So it became this huge concern. And then something fascinating
happened.
But that
really wasn't in the media that much, was it?
It was. I mean, he basically announced a war on drugs, and this was the impetus for that. So it was a reasonably big thing in the media. But what was fascinating about this was that these GIs came home, and instead of having a 95% relapse rate, they had a 5% relapse rate. And people basically said that the government was covering up what was really going on. They couldn't believe this incredibly low number. It turned out that the thing that had happened was, if you think about most drug addiction, and most addiction actually to behaviors as well, it's very context bound. The context reminds you of the sights and the smells and the experiences that are associated with the addictive experience. And it just brings it back to you. It cues you. It's like a Pavlovian thing. So the bell is ringing and the dog starts salivating. Here, if you're addicted to something, you go back to the context, you're reminded of everything that's associated with the addiction, and then it brings it back to you. The thing about these vets is they came back to the US from the lush jungles and the tropics of Vietnam, and it was a completely new context. It was the sort of home-cooked meals they remembered. It was their families. It was social support. And all of these factors meant that they, not many of them relapsed. They had so much support, and they were in such a different space that they ended up not relapsing even close to 95%.
So circumstance, how do you get away from technology?
Exactly.
Not so good. So let's talk about the elements of behavioral addiction.
Yeah, well, so behavioral addiction is actually very similar to substance addiction in many ways. The lines between them are pretty blurry. You know, a lot of substance addiction involves behaviors that lead up to the experience, certain rituals, being in a certain place. Those are all behavioral. The difference is with a behavioral addiction, you don't actually have a substance at all. You don't ingest a substance. You engage in some action. So what that means for a lot of us now is it means firing up your phone or firing up a game console or loading up the watch with the satellite so that you can start running and making sure that you're running a certain distance.
Well, what about the presidential order where if you fly from Istanbul to Washington, D.C., there's going to be nothing bigger than a cell phone? Everybody's like, what? What are we going to do for all those hours?
Yeah, I mean, people really are concerned about it. And if you leave home and your phone falls out of your pocket and shatters into a million pieces, everyone says that they're anxious when that happens. They get this feeling of withdrawal. It's very similar to what happens with drugs, that you get withdrawal symptoms. I ask my students on the first day of class, actually, some classes, if I took your phone and put it in this cupboard just below here and said you locked it there and you couldn't use it for a week, how much would I have to pay you? And the numbers go so high that eventually one enterprising student will say, that's enough for me to go and buy another phone. I will have to bridge that week. I'll need another phone so that at least I have access to something. It's just become such a huge part of our lives that it's hard for us to imagine being without it.
So that's part of it. I mean, there's the cues, the circumstance. What else is there?
Well, a lot of the sort of the experience that makes it so hard to resist is just that there are a whole lot of different features that are sort of baked into these experiences. There are a whole lot of hooks that are baked in. A really big part of a lot of them is uncertainty, that there's a chance you'll get rewards, but there's also a chance that you won't get rewards. Very much like gambling when you're in front of a slot machine, for example.
And ooh, do I want that email to come in or don't I?
Exactly.
What does it say?
Exactly. So it could be email. It could be a text message. It's the question mark over whether something that you release into the world on Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, Snapchat will get the response you're looking for. Humans are just very interested in that feedback. Social feedback in particular is very, very important to us. That's one of the elements, is this uncertainty factor. Another really big element is just how many goals we set for ourselves and how many metrics there are for measuring success now. You've got devices that say you've walked X number of steps and you're this far from getting to 10,000. You've got devices that say, or social media platforms that say you have this many friends or followers and you may have a goal there. You know, we just have so many goals and they're proliferating at an incredible rate that it's more of an issue for us now than ever before. And until we reach those goals, we're obsessively driven towards them.
And we don't actually know how many are conscious versus unconscious. The fact that it can be measured, it's up on the screen. You can't like not see how many friends you have or not know how well you're doing in the video game. It's like, that automatically feeds into that part of yourself of, I want to do better and I want to do more and I can do this.
Yeah, the feedback is so high fidelity. It's so granular that you're always getting a sense of where you stand on every imaginable human endeavor. And I think that pushes us forward. That makes us very obsessed. I sometimes try to run without my running watch. And my running watch tells me every step of the way how fast I'm going, how far I've gone, how far I've got to go, things like that. I am so much happier and I run in the moment so much more when I happen to leave my watch at home or the battery dies or whatever. Just not having those metrics makes us, I think, much happier, much better off in general.
We had very few metrics when we didn't have any technology.
Exactly.
Now, some of the other elements are interesting. Tasks that become slowly more difficult over time, whether that's innate or because we're setting these goals, we constantly make them a little more difficult as we go.
Yeah, so that was fascinating to me. And it's basically this idea that the place where addiction lives is just perfectly sandwiched between too easy and too difficult. And that evolves over time as you get better at things. You have practice effects that kick in. And, you know, we all get better at, say, a video game like Tetris. A lot of us have played the game. You're moving blocks around, trying to make them fit together. When you first play the game, the slowest level of the game is just about as hard as it can be. You need to really start to learn how to use the different keypads and the different buttons and things like that. And then slowly you become better and better and better at the game. And eventually level 6 and 7 and 8 become the levels where they're just slightly harder than what you can cope with. And there's something really compelling to us about being in that zone of just perfect difficulty where you're maximally engaged and you can't defeat whatever it is that you're doing. And you just keep going obsessively towards a goal that actually becomes harder and harder to achieve because it's always getting slightly more difficult.
So your goal is a little beyond reach, but there's also these unresolved tensions that demand resolution, you say. Now, how would you typify that?
Yeah, that's the cliffhanger idea. This is something that I think is a big part of certain addictive experiences, that you've got a story that's half told or a loop that's been opened and that hasn't been closed. And that's how a lot of good storytelling works. Basically, storytelling, the arc of storytelling, is that you open up a question mark and you say to people, here's a thing. I'm not going to tell you the answer yet. You string them along for a bit, and then at the end, you give them the answer. And that's how storytelling generally works. But the way cliffhangers work is if you can extend people longer and longer without giving them the answer, they'll obsess over what you're discussing. And that's what happens with a lot of the most addictive experiences we engage in. If you look at the shows either on TV or on various media that we pay a lot of attention to. So an example of this is the ending to Sopranos, the show The Sopranos. So at the end of the show, Tony Soprano and his family are sitting in a diner and the screen just cuts to black. And a lot of viewers thought that the power had gone out at the TV station. They weren't sure what had happened because it was such a strange way to end 7 years of a series. What that did was people started to debate, was that the end of Tony's life? Had he been shot and that was the end of his life and you experienced the world the way he did? And since his life ended at that moment, so did your interaction with the show. Or since the song Don't Stop Believing by Journey was playing over the top, the last two words you hear are don't stop and then it cuts to black. Maybe this is saying something about how life just goes on and you may not be privy to the life that the Sopranos are leading, but it's going to go on. People are still debating that 10 years later. And it's because it's an open cliffhanger that was never closed. The same is true of Serial, the podcast. There is no resolution there. We don't know if Adnan Syed is guilty or if he actually committed a crime that was discussed in the episodes of Serial. It's basically a murder mystery where the mystery goes on because this is real life and it turns out real life is sometimes complicated. We don't know the answers. People are still talking about Serial. So much of what makes us obsessed is the question mark that's never resolved.
You're listening to Tech Nation. I'm Moira Gunn. My guest today is NYU marketing professor Adam Alter. You may know him from his New York Times bestseller, Drunk Tank Pink, and other unexpected forces that shape how we think, feel, and behave, or from his many journalistic contributions, from Wired to Atlantic to Popular Science and the Washington Post. He's here today with Irresistible, the Rise of Addictive Technology, and the Business of Keeping Us Hooked. Well, there's a bunch of people out there. They don't know what Drunk Tank Pink is. Tell them.
Yeah, Drunk Tank Pink, it's a color. It's the name that was given to a color of pink paint that psychologists used to paint the inside of jail cells, or drunk tanks, as they were called. So the idea was that if you painted these cells this bright pink color, you could calm down the people who were put in those cells after about 15 minutes. They stumbled on this some years ago. What they did originally was they started to paint the inside of classrooms in various Canadian schools, and they tried different colors. And what they found was, with that very preliminary research, that the color pink led the students in the classrooms to behave much better. They were more compliant. They were generally less absent from class. They decided that there was something miraculous about this color pink. They started to use it elsewhere, and they discovered that there was actually a systematic effect, that this color pink calmed people down. It made them a little bit more relaxed, a little bit less aggressive. And so it became known, at least in the culture, as Drunk Tank Pink. And that is an emblem for what I talk about in that book, Drunk Tank Pink. It's about all these forces in the world around us that shape how we think, feel, and behave in ways you might not expect.
Intentionally put there.
Yes, exactly. Well, some of them are. Some of them are and some of them aren't. Some of them, you know, this book, Irresistible, is certainly about cues that I think are intentionally placed into or baked into the experiences we have. Drunk Tank Pink could also be, in some of those, was more like nature, how nature influences our well-being, or how colors influence us, sometimes put there deliberately, but sometimes not.
How did you get the publisher to go along with the title Drunk Tank Pink?
Yeah, it was interesting. We did debate a number of titles, and that one was obviously, it's opaque. When you read it, you have no idea what it means. And I thought that was intriguing. I thought I'd opened up my own cliffhanger there. And by having that title, Drunk Tank Pink, a lot of people had that as an opening to say, so tell us what this means and let's discuss it. And it was a good way to get into the big ideas of the book in a way that was, I think, tractable, that made sense to people. It made concrete what I was talking about in a very abstract way. And I argued that point, and eventually the publisher agreed.
Eventually the publisher said, all right,
exactly.
All right, I'm tired of talking to you about it.
I call that agreeing, but yeah, you may have other terms for it.
There's many ways to go on this. How do you intentionally build these experiences? How do you recover from them? How do you resist them? There's a million of these kind of things, all these issues that are all around. I was particularly interested in goals, as we were talking about earlier, and goals versus systems. Mm. And you're taking from Scott Adams, the famous Dilbert cartoonist. He says, no, no, stay away from the goals. Go for systems. Explain that. What's the difference?
It's a subtle difference, but I think it's a big difference in the end. It makes a big difference to how we interact with the world. So a goal is something that you set as this long-term aim. It's this like flagpole in the distance, and you look at it and you say, that's where I want to be, and I want to reach that. And it's actually kind of debilitating, and there's something inherently flawed about goals, because what you're doing is you're saying, until I get to that flagpole, I'm actually failing. Until I get there, as far as my definition of success goes, I'm not succeeding. Then once you get there, turns out to be very anticlimactic, and a lot of people get there and they feel that they need to set a new goal. Sometimes it escalates, it's a more stringent goal, or it's a different thing altogether. They disengage from what they were doing. So goals are kind of broken. You're either not there yet, or you're there and it turns out it wasn't that much fun to get there in the end as you thought it was going to be. Systems are different. Systems are where you say, I will do this little thing, bite-sized thing every day. So if you're a writer of a book, you don't say as a goal would be, I want to write my book. You say every morning I will wake up and from 9 to 10 a.m. I will write 500 words. And it doesn't matter what the quality of the words looks like. Sometimes it'll be great, sometimes not. But that's my system. And you'll find that you approach what essentially is the goal end state, but you'll do it in a way that gives you these regular rewards, daily rewards, because you have a system that you stick to that itself becomes the sort of little drip feeding of rewards. And people are much better off taking that approach.
Another vestige of our impression of addicts is that some of us are wired for addiction. And so if you don't really have it in your family, or if that's not you, you can avoid it. And yet, you cite that under the right circumstances, we could all become addicts.
Yeah. You know, there are certain human universals, and I think some of those universals are ripe for exploitation. There is a way that if you set up an experience in front of us, we will all find that experience very hard to resist. The example with opening up a loop that you don't close, there is no human who doesn't have curiosity about a story half told. It's just the way we are, and you can exploit that if you like. If you say to someone, I want you to invest 100 hours in this game, and then you'll get to a point where unless you pay $10 or $100 or $1,000, you won't be able to see what comes next. They'll have invested enough time that they'll feel compelled to pay that money. A lot of games do that. There are ways to do things that you can capitalize on these universals that mean that everyone is capable of being addicted. Now, there's certainly something to this general idea of say, an addictive personality. There are people who, I think it really resides in the realm of risk. There are people who are willing to take more risks than others, and they need more stimulation. And for them, often it becomes a matter of obsession. But we are all capable, whether we're that way or not, of becoming addicted, in particular to experiences. And the evidence is just in the numbers. The fact that more than half of us have these behavioral addictions suggests there's something very democratic about them.
And 70% of office emails are read within 6 seconds of arriving?
Yeah, it's an incredible statistic. If you ask people to guess, you could set up a multiple choice quiz. How long do you think it takes for 70% of emails to be read? If you go 6 seconds, 6 minutes, and 60 minutes, I've done this before. No one says 6 seconds. They pick the other two longer options. 6 seconds seems such a short time, and yet that's our relationship with email now.
And, you know, the technology knows how soon you open it up.
Absolutely.
And you have to physically open it up. There's no automatic opening it up, and here it is.
Absolutely.
Boy, so you got some overhead in there to hit the email. You want to do it even sooner. Ooh, got a lot going on there. One of the offshoots of all of this personal technology is that it's interfering with our sleep.
Yeah. So screens release a kind of bluish-white light that you don't see anywhere except during the day. And so if you happen to interact with it at night, the light hits the retina at the back of your eye, and it suppresses the production of melatonin. Melatonin basically makes you sleepy. So what you're doing by using screens within an hour before bed is you're inducing jet lag on a nightly basis, because that's really what jet lag is. And so it really is interfering with our sleep, not just before we go to bed, though. If you happen to sleep with the screen next to you at night, if it lights up during the night, that'll wake you up. But even if it doesn't light up, you will sleep less well and less deeply for the fact that it's nearby and it takes you out of sleep. It makes you think about what else might be going on. If it's not an option, if it's in another room, you tend to sleep more deeply. You don't have this other thing going on that's plaguing you the whole time.
Well, I have to say that,
Yes, my tablet is with me. It's not on the nightstand. It's right there, you know, cozying up to me here. But I have a lot of rules. The rules are, you know, you don't read any email. You don't. There's a couple of little games that I play that are so boring. They put me to sleep. So I kind of bore myself to sleep. And of course, the light is low. It's turned way, you know, it's automatically.
Right.
And otherwise, I would have been sitting there with the light on reading. And then I wake up in the middle of the night and the light's still on, which is kind of crazy. But I think a lot of people have this, I don't know if it's entertaining as you're going to sleep or something that takes you out of the just sitting there thinking about things as you go to sleep. I kind of wonder about this. Can't they make screens that don't issue the blue light?
I mean, you could try. The thing about the screens is they're projecting real life. A lot of the time you're watching Netflix or you're watching a film.
Oh, no. We don't do that on the tablet. No. Not when you're trying to sleep.
Right. So, but even if you're not, let's say you're on the web, even if you're trying not to do that, you're trying to sleep and you happen to navigate to the web or look at an email, just having a white background on the screen or having something real means there will be some of those colors of light emitted that you until recently would never have seen at night. So thinking about evolutionary history, our ancestors only ever saw those colors of light during the day. And so we've learned to know what that means. If you think about nighttime, it was around fires and the reddish yellow warm light. And now all the light that's coming from these screens, even if you aren't doing the wrong things, will be this more sort of cold blue white light.
All you engineers out there, fix this problem.
Yeah.
People need to sleep. Let's talk about World of Warcraft and its addiction test.
Yeah, so I think this may be the most addictive single experience that exists. It's a game, World of Warcraft, and you basically go on missions and you have to achieve certain things. You adopt an avatar and the avatar represents you in this world, the world of Azeroth, and you play these games and people will band together to form guilds. So you'll play with other people in the virtual space and you'll play with their avatars to try and achieve the mission together. And there have been roughly 100 million people who've played this game. And by many accounts, half of them have developed an addiction.
I'm speaking with NYU marketing professor Adam Alter. The book is Irresistible, The Rise of Addictive Technology and the Business of Keeping Us Hooked. We'll talk more after a break. Podcasts of Tech Nation, Biotech Nation, and Tech Nation Health are available at iTunes, Stitcher, and other podcast syndication outlets. Coming up in the second half of our show on Tech Nation Health, Chief Correspondent Daniel Kraft talks about the cutting edge of stem cell therapies today and in the future. And Dr. Kareem Debag from Second Genome talks about linking bacteria in the gut to the inflammation experienced in IBD. Irritable bowel disease. Stay with us. You're listening to Tech Nation. I'm speaking with NYU marketing professor Adam Alter. His book is Irresistible, The Rise of Addictive Technology and the Business of Keeping Us Hooked.
There's actually a professor at the NYU Game Center, so he teaches about games. And he told me it's his job, as far as he's concerned, to play all the culturally significant games, which means that World of Warcraft should be right up there. It should be maybe one or two on that list. He has never played the game. And I said to him, how could you be teaching this when you've never played? And he said, I know so much about this game and I know how dangerous it is to play that I don't trust myself to be able to play in manageable amounts. And I think I'd become addicted and I can't afford that loss of time. So I just don't play for even 1 minute.
I was amazed. One of my students was really big into that, is really big into that. And whenever I asked him to make infographics, he would get all this infographics about gaming and all this kind of stuff and how much time people had and how many points. And it was like so clear that really smart people were really devoting much of their life to this, much of their mind share to this.
Yeah.
You kind of, you know, it's going to be the on my deathbed, I'm not going to say, I wish I played more video games. You know, it's like,
yeah.
It's like looking back on it, it's going to say, this is really an interesting aspect that couldn't have happened basically before now.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's almost it is understandable because for a lot of people, that is it's a social experience and you band together, you're engaged in essentially battle. And if you're engaged in battle, you need to be around when other people are playing so that you're there to support them. So for a lot of people who are playing with other guild members who are far away from them, say you've got someone playing in San Francisco, you've got someone playing in New York, someone in Copenhagen, and someone in Tokyo. You basically have people all across the globe. And that means if you want to be part of this band, this guild, you're going to have to be awake a lot of the time, even when you should be asleep because of the different time zones. So one of the biggest consequences is that people feel that they owe enough to these others that they'll forego sleep to play the game.
And don't think you're off the hook if you don't play World of Warcraft here. I mean, there is an addiction test out there. I suppose you've taken it?
Yeah, I mean, there are a number of different ones. I haven't played much of World of Warcraft myself for the part of the same reason that I'm not sure I trust myself to be able to wean myself off. But there are a lot of people who play the game who take this test regularly. They're anxious about it. They want to know if they're addicted.
Right. I can understand that. But even if you're not playing such a game, it's really difficult just with email. I mean, we had Eric Schmidt on recently, the former CEO of Google.
Right,
and
yeah.
Now the chair of its parent company, Alphabet. And he said, we had a terrible time getting people to go on vacation for just a week and not answer their email.
I've got a solution for that, and it comes from Mercedes-Benz. What they do in Germany is they have this rule that at vacation time, when you go on vacation, what they do is they set up an automatic reply. And what the automatic reply says is, this person is on vacation. The email you've just sent to them has been automatically deleted. If you like, you can forward it on to this other person who is not on vacation, or you can resend it when this other person comes, when this person
so
comes
So you couldn't
back.
See it if you wanted to.
So you couldn't. So what happens is you go on vacation. The way your inbox looks when you go on vacation is the same as how it looks the day you get back. So you aren't spending the first 5 days back trying to clear through emails. And even more importantly, you aren't spending your whole vacation checking just to see, I wonder if there's an email that's really important. Because you know for a fact there will be no email no matter what happens. It's a brilliant way of dealing with it.
It's frightening, isn't it?
That we need to do this is frightening, but I think it's such a great thing to do. I try to imagine what it'd be like to know that I wouldn't have an email for the 4 weeks that I'm on vacation or 2 weeks I'm on vacation. That's so incredibly liberating.
And as a society, as a social entity, if we know that and everybody starts to play by that rule, I think it's really going to change some things.
I hope so. I mean, that's... You know, we're very early on in this, I don't know what it is, this journey, I guess. We've only had, you know, Facebook's 13 years old, and Facebook is now seen as this relic. I mean, if young people think of Facebook as something that their parents and grandparents use, and a lot of them now are on Snapchat and Instagram, and that feels to me like yesterday, the day I remember the first time I used Facebook. And we've come such a long way and we've got so much further to go. And I think the way we think of our norms and the way we think about these sorts of platforms is still really early on. It's, you know, if you think about the evolution, and I'm a little cautious about making this comparison, but if you think about the production of nicotine by big tobacco, the way we think about big tobacco is for a long time, we didn't really judge them. We thought that they were just in business like any other business. And then we started to recognize that there were some things that they were doing that were maybe a bit dangerous and bad for us. And the norm started to change. We demanded more from them. We demanded filters on cigarettes. We demanded different kinds of advertising that didn't target teenagers. We added taxes. We did all sorts of things legislatively to blunt the power of big tobacco. Now, big tech is not killing people in the same way, but it's certainly changing their lives. And I think we're only just now starting to have that conversation. And when I hear from tech experts and people in the tech world, a lot of them say, I'd never even thought about the effect I was having on the world. All I was trying to do was create a program or an experience that was maximally engaging. And that seemed like a good thing, right? I mean, we're all so bombarded with ideas all the time. Why not try to have your idea sit above all the others? What's wrong with that? The problem is the language you use to say, I want something to be maximally engaging is not that far from the language you use to say, I want this to be something people can't stop using. I want it to be addictive. And that's, I think, where we're sort of treading on a shaky boundary.
And the way technology works today, it can be ubiquitous in an instant.
Absolutely. And so much tech now is.
Empathy. You're worried about empathy. It's apparently declining.
Yeah, that's the sense that you get if you talk to experts who deal with children who've spent a lot of their early lives in front of screens. You know, a lot of how we develop empathy is by trial and error. We try things out with other people. You know, you might steal a kid's toy or you make fun of a kid and then you see that their face scrunches up and they look sad and they cry. For most of us, that makes us feel bad and we realize that's not how we want to conduct our lives. You need to do that a number of times when you're young in that early phase to get a sense of what works and what doesn't for you. And empathy comes from that. It's from realizing that your actions have an effect on other people. The problem with interacting through tech and through screens is there's always social distance between you and other people. So even if you bully them, you don't get immediate feedback. If you get feedback at all, it's low fidelity feedback. And so as a result, you don't develop the same empathy that you might develop if you actually see the consequences of your actions. And so that's a really big worry for a lot of developmental psychologists now, that perhaps we're raising generations of kids who happen to have been born into the screen era, who, if they spend enough time with screens and not enough with other people, will not develop the same empathetic or empathic tendencies.
Well, you say a lot about the future as well, but I like this. The key to overcoming addictive behaviors is to replace them with something else.
Yeah.
Okay, what else?
Yeah, I mean, so this is the thing, right? You can't just say, don't use your phone. It has to be, don't use your phone. And while you're doing that for a few hours a day, you need to also do this other thing. It doesn't really matter what the other, what else is. It's just got to be something that's appealing, that's an alternative. So for me, for example, it's, you know, if I try from 5 to 7 p.m. to put my phone in a drawer, I lock it away and I don't use it for a couple of hours. It's so that for an hour of that time, it'll be playing with my son, my baby son, talking to my wife, having dinner, and then the other hour will be at the gym going for a run. Whatever it will be, everyone has their own things that they enjoy doing that they wish they did more of, but tech seems to get in the way. Those are the things you should be doing in those periods of time that you carve aside. And it has to be a replacement. You can't just say, I shouldn't be using so many screens. It has to be, I will use screens less, and here is the thing I will do instead.
Adam, thank you so much. Please come back. See us anytime.
Thanks for having me.
My guest today is NYU marketing professor Adam Alter. The book is Irresistible: The Rise of Addictive Technology and the Business of Keeping Us Hooked. It's published by Penguin Press. You're listening to Tech Nation. Welcome to TechNation Health, reimagining the future of health and healthcare with the emergence of new technologies. Today, our chief correspondent, Daniel Kraft, talks about the cutting edge of stem cell therapies today and in the future, and linking bacteria in the gut to the inflammation experienced in IBD, irritable bowel disease. First up is Dr. Daniel Kraft, chief correspondent for TechNation Health and founder and chair of Exponential Medicine.
I'm a hematologist, oncologist, and bone marrow transplant physician by background and spent a lot of that time synced in the world of stem cell biology and regenerative medicine at Stanford and elsewhere. And I think it's an exciting time for stem cell biology and regenerative medicine. Here in California, we've had the CIRM, Prop 71, which brought a lot of money into the space. And I thought we'd discuss what's the cutting edge of stem cell therapies today and in the future.
Could you start with what's a stem cell? That'd be helpful.
Sure. There's a lot of hype and hope around the world of stem cell biology and regenerative medicine. So you can go to Russia or Mexico and get a stem cell therapy, but often there's no stem cells involved at all. So just to understand what a stem cell is, it is a rare cell in your body, sometimes in different organ systems, that has the ability to regenerate itself, divide and make more of itself, but also to differentiate downstream into mature tissues. And the best example I have from my clinical world is that of the bone marrow stem cell, the blood-forming or hematopoietic stem cell. Those are the cells in your bone marrow which are making billions of new red cells, white cells, and platelets every day. And if you look under your bone marrow, you take a bone marrow biopsy or you put a needle in there and pull out some bone marrow stem cells, about 1 in 1,000 or 1 in 2,000 of those cells will be a bone marrow stem cell. These were first discovered and or described and isolated in mice and then humans at Stanford by Irv Weissman and colleagues. And that's what we use in a bone marrow transplant. If a patient of mine has leukemia and we want to hit them with very high dose leukemia, with high dose chemotherapy and radiation, to hopefully kill the leukemia, it often kills their normal bone marrow stem cells as well. We have to do a bone marrow transplant, ideally from a matched brother or sister, to reboot their immune system. Sometimes you even get your own bone marrow cells back in treating lymphomas, for example. So that's a form of stem cell therapy we've been doing for 40, 50 years. Where that's heading now is we can isolate those particular stem cells, get rid of the T cells, which we often give back, which cause things like graft versus host disease, and start to really manipulate the transplant. And now blend that, not just for treating leukemias, myeloma, but genetic diseases. In the pediatric hematology world, we have a lot of kids with things like sickle cell disease or thalassemia. That's a genetic disorder. A single base pair in the hemoglobin gene makes a cell sickle. These kids often die before they're 20 or 30. We've done bone marrow transplants in those patients, but it's still quite dangerous because those bone marrow donors are or someone related or unrelated to them. We're learning now that we can take out the bone marrow from a sickle cell patient, swap out the bad gene with a good one, gene therapy, and retransplant them with their own stem cells with a modified gene and cure these folks of genetic diseases like sickle cell, like thalassemia, maybe even for HIV. You might remember a couple of years ago, the Berlin patient, the patient with leukemia who also had HIV, got a bone marrow transplant from someone who had a modified CCR5 receptor and was cured of leukemia and of HIV. Now, what if we could knock that gene into an HIV patient without having to have them leukemia at first? And now with CRISPR technology, developed here down the street initially by Jennifer Doudna and others at Berkeley and at the Broad in Massachusetts, a lot of patent disputes in the space, we're seeing that might be a great modality to modify bone marrow stem cells and other stem cells to cure a lot of these genetic disorders.
Well, I think it's important to say why CRISPR, for instance, as a technology, is so important to all of these things in the gene space.
Well, CRISPR technology came out of basic research into how do bacteria communicate and transform themselves, and now is exploding in the field of gene therapy because that CRISPR mechanism that's been taken from bacteria to eukaryotic cells or non-bacterial cells enables us to isolate, identify a particular gene and swap it out in a very specific way. The old forms of gene therapy often would insert a gene pretty randomly and could have other side effects like triggering a potential future cancer. So blending technologies like CRISPR with stem cells is particularly exciting. We can also potentially modify embryos, lots of ethical issues. I like to joke, the Chinese are already doing that in embryos but haven't said they're implanting them into mothers and bringing them to term. But let's look to see what the Olympic team looks like in 20 years. So lots of ethics and other challenges here. And one area in the sort of stem cell biology and regenerative medicine where we're seeing the two combine as well is we know that organ transplants are organs are in short supply for folks who need a heart transplant, liver transplant, et cetera. And while there's work around potentially 3D printing organs from stem cells, I think what's going to happen faster is that we're able to take pigs are often human-sized, have similar organ sizes to humans, and humanize that pig, meaning we can knock out the genes in the pig that make sugar molecules on the surface that humans identify as foreign. We can knock in human immune genes that mark them as human cells. And so this work is moving pretty quickly with a few spin-outs from Harvard where we might have an animal farm type future. If you need a new liver or kidney, you will literally get that liver or kidney from a humanized pig. Might not be kosher, or we could knock in the genes to make the pigs kosher. And that's where we might source our genes, our organ transplants in the not-so-distant future.
Well, before we were able to produce insulin like we were, all the diabetics were injecting insulin from pigs.
Exactly. And so maybe we are going to reboot a bit in that direction. But it's an example of convergence of fields, gene therapy, stem cell therapy. The ability now, of course, with induced pluripotent stem cells, we can take one of Moira's skin cells or a little blood sample, take one of those cells, transform that with the Yamanaka factor. Shion Yamanaka won the Nobel Prize 4 years ago for developing this approach, and make your own personalized stem cell line, induced pluripotent stem cells, the equivalent to an embryonic stem cell line, but coming from that patient. Today, what we can do with that is take, for example, a patient with a disease like Lou Gehrig's disease, ALS. It's hard to study the neurons in that patient, but we can now take their skin cells, transform those to pluripotent stem cells, turn them into neurons, and study those patients' neurons in the dish and maybe understand the disease pathology and drugs that might help that individual patient or help treat ALS in general. The next stage will be to use those sorts of cells therapeutically. And in Japan, they've done the first trials making basically retinal epithelial cells for folks with a form of blindness and treating the patient back with their own retinal epithelial cells derived from their skin cells. So kind of pretty magical that we have this sort of cellular alchemy. It may be that diabetic patients in the future, we can make their own stem cell lines, make beta islet cells, and put them back in those patients to basically give them back a pancreatic function. So lots of potential in the space, lots of regulatory and reimbursement barriers, also a lot of excitement and hype. So we also need to make sure that we're doing these trials well. If you're hearing about some clinic somewhere that's going to cure cancer or Alzheimer's or autism with stem cells, take it with a grain of salt, really research it, look for those double-blind placebo-controlled trials before you jump in.
Thanks so much, Daniel.
Thanks.
Dr. Daniel Kraft is the founder and chair of Exponential Medicine. More information is available at exponentialmedicine.com. Reducing inflammation has long been the challenge in treating IBD, irritable bowel disease. But how bacteria in the gut relate to that inflammation remains a question. Dr. Kareem Debag is the chief scientific officer of Second Genome.
The bacteria have long been proposed to be one of the culprits in the context of inflammatory bowel disease. But it was never really well understood what was the true pathogenic function of those bacteria. And we've spent many years analyzing the GI tract microflora of patients who suffer from inflammatory bowel disease and have been comparing it to patients with other diseases which are not inflammatory, as well as individuals who don't have any problems with their GI tract.
These are trillions of bugs.
Mm-hmm.
How do you do that? How do you look at them all?
You sequence their genomes, and modern technology in DNA sequencing has made it now possible to be able to sequence large numbers of bacteria, and the databases that have been generated have allowed us now to understand which bacteria those genomes we end up sequencing are. So we can get to a very granular view of the bacteria that are populating our GI tracts. So by analyzing that in different types of disease settings, we can now understand which bacteria are present, absent, in various different situations.
Now, your lead compound is trying to block inflammation. How is it trying to do it?
So what ends up happening in the context of inflammatory bowel disease is really a breakdown of a gastrointestinal barrier. And it's not clear why that takes place. We know that it is one of the features of these diseases. And humans and bacteria have evolved to live harmoniously. We have a large amount of bacterial flora in our GI tracts. If that bacterial content were to get into the rest of our bodies, it would be extremely problematic, as we know. Sepsis is one of the diseases that takes place in that context. So what we have found is that in the context of inflammatory bowel disease, that breakdown of that barrier creates bacteria to now interact with the immune system. And in the context of IBD, you get a very aberrant immune response to those bacteria. And what we are trying to do is to tone that inflammatory response down to enable the standard of care drugs to have their effect in those patients, so to have greater patient response.
Now, are you targeting the inflammation, or are you're targeting the bacteria? What are you targeting?
We are targeting the inflammation. So the mechanisms by which human immune system reacts to those bacteria, the first line of defense, if you like. So that's what we are trying to tone down.
Is it of interest which bacteria it is?
You know, it's a good question. I don't think that it's a specific response to one particular bacterial
or
species
set of bacteria, yeah.
Or set of bacteria. I think it's generally wrong place, wrong time. Bacteria are there. They're breaching that barrier, and there's a big immune response that just takes place.
What was the genesis of this compound? How did that come to Second Genome?
So the target itself was developed years back in the pharmaceutical industry. The target of this drug was target by which a particular cytokine was being blocked, a cytokine called IL-1 beta, which is means by which the body triggers a defense, an immune response towards damaging signals, tissue injury, infections. So those pathways were characterized in other diseases such as rheumatoid arthritis, osteoarthritis, and other diseases. And what the industry tried to do was to block this pathway to have an anti-inflammatory effect in those diseases. Well, it turned out that those diseases were not infectious. They were not bacterially driven. And these drugs actually ended up not having an effect in that context. When we analyzed patient samples with inflammatory bowel disease, we found this pathway to be highly active, and we're able to put, if you want, two and two together, the fact that there is a very strong bacterial component and that the industry had developed these drugs to block the pathways. And by putting these two components together, we decided that we wanted to develop a program targeting this mechanism and found a molecule that had been developed to a fairly late stage and brought it into the company and have taken it on from there.
But you still like bacteria. You're looking for other uses of the bacteria you've collected, mm-hmm. right?
Absolutely. We tend to not think about bacteria when we're healthy. They're sort of silent benefactors of us.
It's a mutual relationship I have with my bacteria.
It's very mutual. It's symbiotic. And if you think about, you know, what are ecosystems about? Ecosystems are all about symbiotic relationships. And we happen to be a very big component of our ecosystem where we interact with the bacteria. And in that ecosystem, bacteria perform many beneficial functions that we don't really realize. They metabolize food products. They provide us with nutrients that we otherwise cannot generate ourselves. And we've evolved with them because they've been there performing those functions. We've evolved with them in a beneficially mutual manner. So we are trying to find how the bacteria actually perform those beneficial functions, which were to date not really well understood, and try to discover drugs and medicines based on those findings.
Yeah, we don't know yet, but it's a good scientific pool. Well, let's go back to your lead drug, though, mm-hmm. for IBD. Where are you in that lab bench to market-ready product arc?
We are entering first-in-man studies where we are going to evaluate the safety and the tolerability of that drug in healthy individuals. So the very starting point of human clinical testing. So that's where we are.
Well, you had a lot of work ahead of you on
yes.
all counts.
It's quite a long path before you get to the market. We are also interested in the same pathway in some patient subsets where the unmet medical need is high and where you can actually try to get to the market faster based on the unmet need that you're trying to address. So there are indications in the context of inflammatory bowel disease, such as pouchitis, where patients don't really have many alternatives for their treatments and require, you know, surgical interventions. So we're trying to actually evaluate whether or not the same bacterial abnormalities are taking place in those patients as well.
What I find so fascinating here is that you are pursuing therapeutics the same way any therapeutics company, professional mm-hmm. therapeutics company Absolutely. Would do, but you have this enormous body of knowledge that surrounds bacteria. You know, we're not totally sure how that's going to come, but you have it. Mm-hmm. And I think at the end of the day, it'll be very interesting to see how they inform each other.
No, absolutely. And I think, you know, what was interesting for me in coming to Second Genome and working there was the marriage, I think, between big data and bioinformatics and computational biology and human disease understanding. And my training has been one where you think about a very clearly defined mechanism, where you have a very clearly defined hypothesis, and you test the hypothesis, and you know whether it's true or false, and based on that, you take a biological action, right? Medicine or an intervention based on that. I think where the science of the microbiome is taking us is in the broader context of how does the human biology interact with ecosystem biology, and that includes diet, bacteria, etc. And I think that technology around bioinformatics and much greater data integration is going to reveal certain findings that we otherwise did not have before in terms of human biology and the human symbiotic relationship with the environment.
No data, no knowledge. I'll be darned.
Yes. And the more data, the better the knowledge, if you want.
Well, Kerim, thank you so much. Please come back. See me again.
We will. Thank you.
Dr. Kerim Debeg is the Chief Scientific Officer of Second Genome. More information is available at secondgenome.com. For TechNation Health, I'm Moira Gunn.
TechNation and its regular segment BiotechNation are produced at the studios of KQED-FM in San Francisco. Executive producer is Matt Gardner. The director of technical production is Monte Carlos. And audio engineers include Howard Gelman, Seal Mahler, and Larry Upton. Our theme music was composed by Ann Nachtrieb-Zesiger and Robert Powell, with title creation provided by NameLab Incorporated of San Francisco. Program information and internet audio is available on the web at technation.com. TechNation and BiotechNation are productions of TechNation Media. I'm Paul Landcore.